Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Wednesday, November 16th, 2016. New York City's Mayor Bill de Blasio met with President-elect Donald Trump at Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue today. De Blasio says he asserted the needs and concerns of New Yorkers outside the transition bubble. De Blasio raised concerns over any deregulation of Wall Street or cutting taxes on the rich, and he conveyed worries about proposed deportations. He told Trump anything that would cause a rift between police and community would be counterproductive, and de Blasio says he brought up stop and frisk, one of his advisors Rudy Giuliani's favorite policies. De Blasio says he told Trump how stop and frisk was overused and used in an unconstitutional manner, that since the policy had changed, the city had gotten safer, that the city is never going back to that policy. He spoke with Trump about the Muslim community and fears that are being stoked in that community and that 900 Muslims are within the NYPD. De Blasio said infrastructure is an obvious area where the city can work together with the Trump administration.
I can simultaneously have my own beliefs and my own concerns, but be ready to work with the president-elect on the issue of infrastructure because it would have a hugely positive impact on millions of New Yorkers and hopefully put a lot of people back to work. So that's one area where if these plans are consistent, it's certainly an area where we're going to try and work together. But again, I think the right way to start a relationship is to put your cards on the table. And all of these other concerns are being felt by New Yorkers very deeply right now. I tried to express to him how much fear there is. How much fear there is in communities all over this city. A whole range of people in the biggest city in the country who are fearful about this current dynamic and how we need to see things that will give people more assurance that all New Yorkers and all Americans will be respected.
Economist Professor Rick Wolf says capitalism itself is to blame for Donald Trump. He offers us a perspective on the election.
Basically, in my judgment, neither of the major candidates, neither Trump nor Clinton, was able or willing to deal with the major fundamental economic issues confronting the United States. Those issues are, very simply, the extraordinary inequality of wealth and income that has developed over the last 30 years, and the extraordinary instability of the United States capitalist system that crashed in 2008, crashed even worse back in the 1930s, took downturns 11 times between those two dates, is therefore the kind of instability that shouldn't be endured by anybody. Neither of the two candidates have anything remotely approaching a program to deal with inequality and instability. Those problems are only getting worse, and the new Trump administration will be very quickly exposed as having little or nothing to say on the issues that are agitating the American people. And I expect there will be growing difficulties and tensions as that becomes clear.
Now, this afternoon, Mayor de Blasio met with Donald Trump, and he said he raised concerns over his tax program, over the deregulation of Wall Street, the repeal of Dodd-Frank, and he said that he was very concerned about any tax cuts. What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, I think that while I applaud Mayor de Blasio's pushing in that direction, it's highly unlikely to work because Mr. Trump has made fundamental commitments in the campaign, and he has the alliance that he depends on with the Republican Party. Both of those two are committed to cutting taxes and rolling back Dodd-Frank as a regulatory mechanism. Is it possible for a president simply to disregard and go back on the promises he made? Sure, it's possible. But for a man who squeaked into office with less popular votes than his opponent, he's not in a position to undercut anything of the slender majority he has. So my guess is he's going to go ahead and do what the Republicans have always wanted, what he promised, and what, in his strange view, might help the American economy. So I would not hold my breath if what you were counting on was what Mr. de Blasio was trying to persuade him to consider.
And what's your opinion on some of Trump's appointments and also organizing going forward?
I'm as frightened and distressed by Mr. Bannon's appointment as a strategist, whatever exactly that means, as is the rest of the country. You're taking a person with known extreme right-wing perspectives that are rejected by an overwhelming majority of the American people and saying you have confidence in the strategic advice he will give you. That should worry everybody, not just about Mr. Bannon and what he will push for, but what's going on in the mind of a president-elect who would do such a thing. In terms of policies, I'll just give you one idea. Over the last weekend, the Chinese government indicated that if Mr. Trump were in fact to go through with his proposal to slap a 45% tariff on Chinese goods coming into the country, the Chinese will, of course, react, as will other countries that were put in such a position. They will, in turn, stop American goods from coming into China, just as a tariff would try to do that with Chinese production coming here. Since the United States exports in excess of $100 billion to China, to have that stuff cut off will lose us as many jobs as Mr. Trump tells us we will gain by closing ourselves off to the Chinese. He talked like that during the campaign because he didn't have to face the barrage of criticism of what he was doing. Now that he's actually going to be in office and faces what other governments are going to do, this luxury of blabber without substance is going to be shrinking for him.
Professor Wolf, you will be at the Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, beginning at 7 p.m. Can you give us a preview?
Yes, my job there is to speak at a meeting of the Democracy at Work New York chapter. They have asked me to talk about the longer term economic consequences of what Trump is saying he's going to do, as well as what's likely to really happen, in order that Americans can begin to think about how to oppose, how to push back against a set of economic changes that not only don't deal with the inequality and instability of our economy, but promise to make them worse.
Rick Wolf is Professor of Economics Emeritus at UMass Amherst and a visiting professor in the Graduate Program in International Affairs of the New School University in New York. Professor Wolf is also co-founder and active contributor of his nonprofit Democracy at Work and host of WBAI's Economic Update. It's heard Friday mornings at 9 a.m. or you can listen on WBAI's archive at WBAI.org. Also today, Trump's team met with charter school advocate Eva Moskowitz. According to a senior Trump official, she is being considered to serve as education secretary. Moskowitz, a former New York City council member and a Democrat, has clashed with Mayor Bill de Blasio and with public school officials and teachers over the expansion of some of her charter schools into public school spaces and over harsh disciplinary tactics used, as well as critiques that her schools are not open for all students. House Democrats have sent a letter to President-elect Trump asking him to rescind his appointment of Breitbart News executive Steve Bannon as senior White House advisor. The letter, which has signatures from 169 out of the 188 Democrats in the House, says the appointment of conservative flamethrower Bannon undermines Trump's ability to unite the country. It points out stories from the website that are derogatory towards Jews and Muslims, among other groups. The letter says millions of Americans have expressed fear and concern about how they will be treated by the Trump administration, and your appointment of Mr. Bannon only exacerbates and validates their concerns. With Trump as president-elect, there's talk of the Democratic Party being a failure in many respects. Here's sociologist, author, and Columbia University professor Todd Gitlin.
The Democratic Party obviously failed. The Democratic Party has lost traction and connection with people in the swing states. It's not just the notorious white working class voters, but it's a whole lot of voters. It obviously failed to rouse enthusiasm. I would say the greatest failing is that the activist people, whatever their exact politics in the Democratic Party, have not built local strength. two-thirds of the states are controlled now, lock, stock, and barrel by the Republican Party. They rescind voting rights. They organize redistricting. They make it harder to vote. And thus they damaged the Democrats. Moreover, the Democrats had a candidate who could not speak to the generalized anger. So there's very much that's wrong. Now, about the resistance in the streets, I'm for it. But if it incites the anger and fury of the people who already decided that the Democratic Party is nothing but the broken establishment, then it actually worsens the situation. People need to be committed to long-term political work, and that remains to be seen.
And so that means running locally for offices, and that means getting out and talking to other people and organizing. That's
means,
what you're saying.
It means doing politics, which means engaging with people at local levels. It means choosing candidates because of their progressive values and their responsible conduct, that is to say, their plausibility as political leaders. It requires brokering bargains and relinquishing the drive for purity. It requires acting like a political party, acting like a machine.
But right now, there's a fear out there on the streets in New York City. People are afraid. Immigrants are afraid. Families are afraid of losing loved ones. So there's a lot of that that people are countering, and they're saying, we're not going anywhere.
Well, I mean, I think that's good. I understand there are groups of people getting together to defend immigrants and people of color, to volunteer to accompany them. Make sure that the police are remember that they represent all the citizens. I think there needs to be solidarity with immigrants and Muslims and others. This is a very high priority.
But when there's an appointment of someone like Steve Bannon, spokesperson or organizer or a person in charge of Breitbart, that just stokes fear more, and people are upset by this. There's been a lot of lashing out about it. Can you tell us what you think?
It's reasonable to be alarmed by the appointment of Steve Bannon, a man who is at home with white supremacy, to put it mildly. The fear is rational. The fear is reasonable. And one should react in such a way as to resist and resist effectively.
What can you tell us about him and some of his views?
Well, I'm not an expert on Breitbart. I mean, Breitbart is, however, I can say in general, it traffics in crackpot conspiracy theories. It traffics in racist assumptions, racist hysterias. It plays fast and loose with the truth. It is a far right propaganda organization, and the news, at least the rumor that they're planning expansions in Europe, is truly alarming, because Trump now belongs to a global international of extreme nationalists and exclusivists, tribalists. And Breitbart, it seems as though Breitbart is poised to play a large role in the furthering of that international.
And what about anti-Semitism on the part of Breitbart and accusations that Bannon is an anti-Semite? And can you say what you think in terms of how one could be anti-Semitic but yet still have a relationship with Israel?
Okay, so let's start with the Trump campaign.
That's really complicated, isn't it?
I mean, whether Trump personally is anti-Semite is completely irrelevant. I've never broken bread with the man and don't have any intention to try. What is clear is that people in his inner circle were living inside a media capsule, a social media capsule, in which they were receiving anti-Semitic tweets repurposing their imagery. That's the famous yellow star, the famous gas chamber pictures, the Auschwitz survivor pictures that were retweeted by fanatical Trump supporters and directed at Jewish journalists. It's very clear that inside, at the very heart of the Trump world, where the tweets were coming from, somebody was fully at home, at least one person was fully at home with the cesspools of anti-Semitism. We saw further when one of those reporters, Julia Yaffe, wrote a profile of Melania Trump in GQ, and some of his followers didn't like what they did. They started vamping on her. And she was asked, Melania the next day was asked, what about all of your supporters who are threatening violence against this woman? And she said, well, I don't support that. But she brought it upon herself. That tells you something about the respect these people have for freedom of the press. They don't. These are people with a gangster disposition. So anti-Semitism is part of a complex of views that obviously have an honored position in the Trump campaign. And Bannon certainly seems to be in furtherance of that spirit, that vicious and stupid spirit, and dangerous spirit, I should add. We've seen the quotes from his ex-wife about how he didn't want their kids to go to a school which had too many Jews in it. There's a lot more to find out about Mr. Bannon, which I don't have at my fingertips. But I'm not aware that they have ever, Breitbart or the Trump people, ever seriously taken steps to recognize that the KKK supports them for a reason, that the white nationalists support them for a reason. They're all crowing and very excited that their guy is in the White House. Now, as for the Christian right is ultra-Zionist. They tend to support the occupation of the West Bank. They are savagely opposed to two-state arrangements. They are the far right of the Zionist movement. So whether the far right of the Zionist movement is represents Christian apocalypse believers who look for a coming Armageddon in Israel once all the Jews go there, or whether they are old-fashioned Jew haters of different stripes, they converge in their belief that Israel is a blessed country, is a uniquely blessed country, and that Palestinians are dirt.
And this will probably be reflected in Trump's policies, but we don't know yet.
Well, your guess is as good as mine, but I don't see any reason to doubt that his policies will tilt in that direction. I mean, this is not a man who has any feeling for people who suffer. He only has feeling for winners. The worst thing you can be in his book is a loser.
Todd Gitlin is professor of journalism and sociology and chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. He is the author of 16 books. His forthcoming book is a novel called Opposition. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Today, New York Senator Chuck Schumer was picked to succeed Nevada Senator Harry Reid, who is retiring in January after 30 years in the Senate. Schumer says Democrats will work with Trump on issues where they agree, but challenge him when values or progress is under assault.
We're not going to just, as some have done here in the past, said just because it's President Trump's idea or thought, we're going to oppose it per se. Where we can work together, we will. But I've also said to the president-elect, on issues where we disagree, you can expect a strong and tough fight.
Schumer said, when you lose an election like this, you can't flinch. Harry Reid, addressing the Senate on the election, says it's unprecedented that the man who was elected president lost the popular vote by more than 2 million votes. And he called for Trump to rescind his appointment of Steve Bannon.
We have responsibility to be the voice of millions of Americans sitting at home, afraid that they're not welcome anymore in Donald Trump's America. We have a responsibility to prevent Trump's bullying, aggressive behavior from becoming normalized in the eyes of America, especially the millions of young people who are watching and wondering. For example, if sexual assault is now a laughing matter. We have a responsibility to say that it is not normal for the KKK, Ku Klux Klan, to celebrate the election of a president they view as their champion with a victory parade. They have one scheduled. In other words, we have a responsibility to lead. Outside this Senate chamber, you can hear hammering. We have workers that are hammering on the platform for the inauguration ceremony. It'll take several months to do it, but it'll be done right. In 65 days, Donald Trump will step onto that platform. For 4 years, he will yield the loudest and most powerful microphone in the world. But even as those workers hammer away on Trump's platform, even as we as leaders accept the results of this election, we must also give voice to those who are afraid, because there are many that are afraid. Indeed, a majority of Americans oppose Donald Trump. Many of my Republican colleagues in this chamber oppose Trump. And they weren't alone. Trump will be the first president to take office, having lost a popular vote by 2 million. Every day for the past week, a majority of American voters have awakened to a difficult reality. Not only did that man who lost the popular vote win the election, but his election sparked a rise in hate crimes, threats of violence. Since Election Day, the Southern Poverty Law Center has reported hundreds of incidents of harassment and intimidation. Last count, 315 from their calculations. Overwhelmingly, the hateful acts at a Muslim, at a Hispanic, at a African American, at a woman, at a LGBT, at a Semitic, and at a Asian. I've heard these stories from friends and family. My and my wife's Nevada physician is a Pakistani American of Muslim faith. We think so much of him. We've known each other for 35 years. The day after the election, my friend was in a restaurant in Las Vegas having dinner. A man, in approaching him in a threatening manner, said, "Where are you from?" He said, "Where are you from?" The man that approached him said, "I'm local." The doctor said, "So am I." That same night, in another restaurant in Las Vegas, a Pakistani physician was having dinner. A man walked up to him in the same manner, said, "Where are you from?" He said, "I'm from Pakistan." He said, "Why don't you go back?" One of my staffers has a daughter in middle school. I've known that little girl since she was a little baby. The day after the election, the principal addressed the entire student body on the school's PA system because the two incidents had occurred that he wanted to talk to them about. In one instance, a boy yelled at a Latina student, telling her that he was glad she was going to be deported now that Trump was president. In another instance, a boy was sent home for yelling the most derogatory, hateful term at an African-American student. The boy justified himself by saying he used that language now that Trump was president. In Spokane, Washington, the Martin Luther King Center there was defaced with the same hateful word. Those are only a few examples of what people close to me have related. Many of our fellow Americans believe that Trump's election validates the kind of bullying, aggressive behavior Trump modeled on a daily basis. How can we teach our children that bragging about sexual assault is abhorrent if we rush into the arms of a man who dismissed it as locker room talk? If we fail to hold Trump accountable, we all bear a major responsibility for normalizing his behavior. Here's a letter from a seventh grader from Rhode Island. She wrote it the day after the election, and I direct quote from the letter. Seventh grader. I'm extremely scared, especially being a woman of color, that the present country that I was born and live in is making me feel unsafe when I actually shouldn't feel unsafe. It's even scarier because this man, who is now the president of the United States of America, has said such rude, ignorant, and disrespectful things about women and all different types of people, and is now in charge of our country. I want to feel safe in my country, but I no longer can feel safe with someone like Donald Trump leading the country. Close quote, end of letter. Our president is supposed to make people feel safe. But on Wednesday, a seventh grade girl woke feeling frightened to be a woman of color in America because Donald Trump was president-elect. If we ignore her voice and other voices, this seventh grader will be left to conclude that we as a nation find her fear acceptable. How do we show her that she doesn't have to be afraid? The first step is facing reality. No matter how hard the rest of us work, the main responsibility lies within the man who inspired the fear. President-elect Trump must act immediately to make America, like that seventh grade girl, feel that they are welcome in his America. Healing the wounds he inflicted will take more than words. Talk is cheap and tweets are cheaper. Healing the wounds is going to take action. But so far, Mr. President, rather than healing these wounds, Trump's actions have deepened them. In one of his very first, if not his first official act, he appointed a man seen as a champion of white supremacy as a number one strategist in the White House. Number one. Everybody else is under him. According to CNN, and I quote, white nationalist leaders are praising Donald Trump's decision to name Stephen Bannon as his chief strategist, close quote. In the same article, white nationalist leaders say they see Bannon, quote, as an advocate for policies they favor, close quote. And according to the Poverty Law Center, Bannon, quote, was a main driver between Breitbart becoming a white ethno-nationalist propaganda mill, close quote. When asked to comment on Bannon's hiring, KKK leader David Duke told CNN, again a quote, I think that's excellent, close quote. A court filing stated that Bannon said, again another quote, that he doesn't like Jews and that he doesn't like the way they raise their kids to be whiny brats, and that he didn't want his girls to go to school with Jews, close quote. That's court document. By placing a champion of white supremacists a step away from the Oval Office, what message does Trump send to the young girl who woke up Wednesday morning in Rhode Island afraid to be a woman of color in America? It's not a message of healing. If Trump is serious about seeking unity, the first thing he should do is rescind his appointment to Steve Bannon. Rescind it. Don't do it. Think about this. Don't do it. As long as a champion of racial division is a step away from the Oval Office, it will be impossible to take Trump's efforts to heal the nation seriously. So I say to Donald Trump, take responsibility. Rise to the dignity of the office of President of the United States instead of hiding behind your Twitter account. And show America that racism, bullying, and bigotry have no place in the White House or in America.
Outgoing Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid addressing the Senate. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, November 16th, 2016. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.